The content shared on Your Life, Your Wealth Network reflects the views of the host and guests of the program only and are not necessarily the views of Cordasco Financial Network or its advisors. This media production is educational in nature and should not be construed as financial, legal, or tax advice or a solicitation or presentation of sale of any financial products or services. Please consult a professional prior to making any financial, tax, or legal decisions.
Welcome to the Your Life, Your Wealth Network, helping you find clarity and comfort for your life and wealth. Now, here's your host, financial advisor and CEO of Cordasco Financial Network, Steve Cordasco.
And welcome to the Your Life, Your Wealth show. I'm Steve Cordasco. We're going to spend some time talking about the markets with regards to all the market volatility this somewhat of a correction phase. Some are now wondering, are we in bear market territory with money invested or money in investments? And it doesn't seem as if there's really a single investment class out there that, at least through October 31st, has held up in positive territory. As of October 31st, looks as if 98% of asset class investments are down, and we haven't seen that in a while. To hear to talk about the market's volatility and what's happening within the current market environment is Joe Cortese. He's a senior consultant at DeMayo Schneider and part of our investment team that we focus on at DeMayo Schneider. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Steve.
Let's talk about all the stuff going on in the markets right now. Lots of volatility. What is driving volatility right now, according to what you guys at DeMayo are looking at?
I mean, I think the main drivers are a couple things. One, you just don't have the amount of Fed-injected liquidity sloshing around in the system that you had, you know, over the last couple years as the Fed was, embarking on quantitative easing. We're now, you know, we're now in quantitative tightening, right? So pulling liquidity out of the system, making monetary conditions a little less growth-oriented. So that's one, Fed policy, which leads to rising interest rates. And, of course, we're transitioning to a new regime of probably a rising interest rate environment as opposed to, you know, what we saw over the really the last 30 or 40 years going back all the way to the 80s where you had interest rates declining through that period. And now we're in a tightening cycle, as I was saying. So, you know, less liquidity, higher interest rates, and then just the macro political uncertainty that's out there, both here in the U.S. And abroad, are really what's weighing on the markets, and that's kind of what's causing a lot of volatility. And I guess the last thing I would note is, again, we're in the ninth year of the longest bull market in history now, and the market's vulnerable, right? I mean, you've had a substantial, greater than 3x return in the S&P 500 since the depths of the financial crisis. And, you know, a lot of people are looking for any excuse to take profits.
So what should investors do? Those that are planning for their retired years, those that might be in retirement, let's take a look at maybe baby boomers and those north of the age of 50 that are now kind of in that red zone where the wealth that they've accumulated, which needs to last them for the rest of their lifetime, and they've been kind of grown up on the markets and their wealth has been tied to the markets, and they've been part of this almost 30-year cycle now of rates coming down to the lowest we've seen in probably history, now going the other way. What do they do?
Well, I think there's a couple things. First of all, I think you have to maintain, or more than ever today, it makes sense to maintain a broadly diversified stance. Right. So it's hard to think about concentrating in any one asset class, whether it be fixed income or equities, given the amount of volatility that we're seeing across markets. The good news about higher interest rates, though, is that those closer to retirement or in retirement can get more income out of their fixed income, out of the fixed income portion of their portfolio. Right. So, you know, what with a 10-year bond at 3.1% today and a 30-year bond at, you know, around 3.4, you know, not super exciting yields. However, it's better than the, you know, 2% yields that we saw just a year ago or so. So in that case, you can have a little bit more of your assets on the safer or fixed income or less risky side of the portfolio. But, you know, you probably do need to maintain some exposure to risk assets to continue to protect against inflation and purchasing power going forward, understanding that on average, people are spending about 20 years in retirement these days.
So when we talk fixed income, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking bonds. And bonds, I think, are the household term for putting your money into or diversifying into something that's not as risky as stocks. There's also, you know, insurance products out there. But that's why a lot of us who are financial advisors or navigating people's money, we kind of block bonds into an overall category called fixed income. Right, Joe? So under the fixed income umbrella, it's a broader name, you'll find bonds and you might find some other stuff in there too, right? There's things in the fixed income space that aren't just pure bonds. But when we say fixed income, we're talking about investments that are not in stocks and in the stock market. Is that fair, Joe?
Yeah, that's very accurate. And again, it goes back to my comments about maintaining a very broadly diversified stance. Even within fixed income, we're not owning one type of bond. We're owning, you know, core U.S. bonds like U.S. Treasury securities, agency securities, and for those taxable investors, municipal bonds of various types. We've got, you know, things like high yield bonds in the portfolio to increase yield a little bit, not owning the, you know, the lowest quality sort of junk bonds, but just moving down in the credit quality spectrum a little bit to increase yield somewhat. We've also got allocations to international bonds in portfolios. And in fact, one of the bright spots this year, still in positive territory, are international bonds where that foreign currency component is hedged back to the U.S. dollar. Are actually still in positive territory to the tune of about 1.5% this year. Again, not an exciting return, but understanding that core domestic treasuries, agency securities are down about 2.25% this year, you know, you can see how having that allocation to bonds outside of the U.S., but hedging that back to the U.S. dollar has helped this year.
When you say we, that's Cardasco Financial Network, because Joe, you're part of the investment team here as we navigate people's money. And so when we talk, we're talking in terms of what we're doing and what we're strategizing with regards to the bond or the fixed income part of people's money.
That's absolutely right.
And we made a decision to go a little bit more into the high yield space. I think, you know, prior going into this particular year, and that area has been doing okay, but the area of agencies and treasuries are taking it on the chin a bit. I want to get into the dollar, talk about that a little bit. But before we do that, let's talk about a specific strategy with regards to bonds and how to play bonds. Because, you know, a lot of folks say, well, wait a minute, if interest rates are going up, Steve, you've always taught me it's like a seesaw. Rates go up, the value of bonds go down. So if people are in a bond fund and they're either in retirement, getting close to retirement, saying, well, geez, I just heard, you know, Steve Cardasco and Joe Cortese talk about how they're positioning portfolios for investors. Hence, a rising interest rate environment is going to be good for me because I'm closer to retirement. In retirement, I'm going to get more income. But doesn't that make my money worth less that the income's coming off of? Which brings me to mutual funds, because a lot of people today do use mutual funds as their fixed income or bond portion. In the past, buying individual bonds and laddering bonds, the bond ladder strategy, which means you're buying, I don't know, let's say you're putting a chunk of money into bonds, you're buying some bonds with shorter maturities, some bonds that come due in kind of middle range territories, and then you have some longer term bonds that could run out north of 10 years. And it's almost like when people were putting money in CDs when rates were high. Back in 1981, nobody was putting their money into the long-term CD to get double-digit returns. They were still buying the 3, 4, 5 month, maybe 1, 2 year, staying short-term because rates kept changing so fast. So is this an environment that people should be positioning in bond ladders where they stagger out their own bond portfolio? Or are mutual funds the best place to be right now in the space of bonds in a rising interest rate environment?
So it's a great question, and a couple things I would say. First of all, let's go back and talk about the high-level rationale for having bonds in portfolios, right? So, you know, we do hear from investors from time to time, rates are going up. We know that's going to cause bond prices to go down. Let's get rid of bonds entirely. And the answer to that is that's absolutely the wrong strategy. And because in a portfolio where you've got diversified assets and many different asset classes, when we get into a difficult environment for growth assets like equities and those sorts of things, and they sell off considerably, bonds are going to be impacted to a lesser extent. They may be a little bit negative, but they're certainly not going to be as negative as the growth side or the equity side of the portfolio in a bear market, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so they act as that ballast or that anchor in the portfolio to reduce volatility, provide stability. And then really, you know, we always want to buy low and sell high, right? So if equity markets go down 10 or 20%, we can trim our bond allocation a little bit and take those assets and invest them on the equity side as those markets are, you know, sort of at the bottom of the sell-off. So that's really important. We always want to have some allocation of bonds in portfolios. And then to your question about bond fund versus ladder, the real issue with that today is, and it gets a bit technical, but the flatness of the yield curve. If folks are familiar with, you know, the yield curve, it's typically upward sloping, meaning that rates in the short term are typically lower than longer term rates. And that makes sense because there's just, you know, more uncertainty associated with, you know, longer time frames. And so then the cost of money or borrowing or interest rates, therefore, are higher on the long end of the yield curve. The issue is in today's environment with the Fed increasing short term interest rates and the long end of the yield curve really not moving much, you've got a very, very flat yield curve. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, we've got a 10-year bond with a yield of about 3.1%. And we've got a 30-year bond with a yield of about 3.4%. So, you know, you're looking at a yield spread from 10 to 30 years of about 30 basis points or less than one-third of 1%. That's not a lot of room. So, therefore, if you're laddering out bonds, you're really not getting paid or compensated adequately, you know, to have bonds that are extremely far out on the yield curve, as opposed to, you know, taking less risk and owning more short, intermediate or shorter term bonds. So that's why it's a little bit difficult for us today to recommend laddered strategies, just because we don't feel like you're getting compensated for taking that extra, what we call duration risk or that longer time frame risk. The other thing I would point out is, again, it goes back to diversification. For most investors that are investing a portion of their assets in bonds, it's very difficult for them to get adequate diversification to own enough different bonds, different types of bonds in a portfolio, just building it out on their own, mm-hmm. understanding that, you know, bonds typically trade at $10,000 blocks or $100,000 blocks and even, you know, greater in the institutional markets. So therefore, that's what makes mutual fund investing and using mutual funds to gain exposure to the bond markets attractive, because these mutual fund portfolios, very, very large, many, many billions of dollars. And when an investor buys into that pool of assets, you're getting that immediate diversification of bonds really across markets without having to do it on your own and without sacrificing diversification. So for most investors, fixed income mutual funds make a ton of sense because of that instant diversification you get buying into that larger pool of assets.
And Joe Cardese is my guest. He's a senior consultant at DeMeo Schneider, part of our investment team at Cardesco Financial Network. Let's jump into stocks and this environment that we're in with the stock market. People want to know, are we in a bear market? Are we venturing into a bear market right now? And what is the driving force behind this correction in the marketplace?
Well, so if you take the classic definition of a bear market, which is a peak to trough decline in the equity markets of 20%, we're definitely not in a bear market. In fact, we haven't even breached the 10% level yet, which is sort of the classic definition of a correction, if you will. And also keep in mind, we already had one of these this year. It's so funny how quickly we forget these things. But January and February, we had a pretty pronounced sell-off in the equity markets, and we almost got to 10% there. We got to about a 9.9% peak-to-trough decline in the S&P 500 from the high to the low in that period. And then we hit new highs again late summer, early fall. So let's keep that in mind. This is how financial markets behave, right? They're volatile from time to time, and we're living through a period of volatility.
But so, we've been spoiled going into this time. So I guess that's fair to say too, right?
Yeah, and that's why this year probably feels a little tougher than most because of the lack of volatility that we saw last year, the fact that markets were up, you know, substantially really across the board, and there was historically low volatility in the equity markets. And so I think that's why a lot of investors feel that this year has been particularly tough, because they're, you know, the recency bias is comparing it a little bit to last year and how, frankly, how good last year was.
What's the consensus of where we're going from here? Do we need a bear market in here? Do we need that peak to trough 20% to position us for the market to reward moving forward?
It's a good question. It's really tough to, you know, sort of call short-term market moves. So we tend to, you know, take a step back, look at the data. I mean, you mentioned BlackRock talking about perhaps lower equity returns going forward. I would have to say I agree with that, because, you know, if you look at the historical data through September 30th, the most recent quarter end, the seven-year return on the S&P 500 was a 17% annualized return over 7 years. That's more than double the long-run range annualized return for the S&P 500. And in financial markets, obviously, reversion to the mean is a very powerful force. So anytime that you've more than doubled your long-run historical annualized return for 7 years, you're very likely to have a period of lower returns, again, then to get those annualized returns back in line with where they are historically, which is more around like an 8 or a, you know, a 7 or an 8%, depending on if you're looking at total return or just price return, those sorts of things. So, you know, but that doesn't mean that, you know, we have to have a 10 or 20 or 30% correction in the equity markets. It's very hard to tell. But one of the things we look at is, I mean, the underlying economy here in the U.S. is still really strong. And if we compare, you know, this period of elevated volatility to the last period of sustained elevated volatility that we saw, was really sort of 2014 through 2016, you know, there's a lot of bright spots in that during that 2014 to 2016 period, you saw credit spreads or bond, like corporate bonds versus U.S. Treasury bonds, that spread really widened during that 2014 to 2016 period. So the prices of corporate bonds sold off a lot faster than the prices of treasury bonds, again, back to that sort of flight to quality or flight to safety dynamic we talked about. We are nowhere near that type of spread widening in this period that we saw in the 2014 through 2016 period. The other thing we look at is inflation expectations. In the 2014 to 2016 period, you saw inflation expectations decline precipitously because, of course, you know, if markets are tough, if the economy is going to go into recession, you don't have rising prices in that type of an environment. You don't have inflation. You have a lack of inflation or even deflation. And we saw a pretty precipitous decline in inflation expectations in 2014 through 2016. And we're just not seeing that today. Inflation expectations, while they've come down a little bit, mostly as a result of the recent decline in oil prices, they're still relatively stable overall. Last thing I would point out is that, you know, we look at a lot of the underlying metrics in the equity markets, and we look at things like forward multiples on the S&P 500 and price-to-earnings ratios and all of those sorts of things, and you're just not yet seeing the decline in those fundamental metrics this time around that we saw in the last period of sustained volatility in 2014 through 2016. So the metrics that I've just mentioned, along with a number of others, they still point to a relatively healthy, relatively robust U.S. economy, which means that, you know, it doesn't seem like a recession is on the horizon in the short term. Could be longer term. Who knows? But, you know, you can still have a volatile equity market outside of the fact that the U.S., the underlying U.S. economy is okay. But what that tells us is that we're not in a sort of another financial crisis period or anything like that. This could be a more healthy sort of pullback in the equity markets than would allow us to begin to grow again down the road.
So let's take a look at it. And for those that we want to help educate in what we're talking about, because we sometimes go to a very high level when we start talking these terms and we're talking about the U.S. equity markets, and, you know, people are sizing it up and saying, well, wait a minute, you know, inflation's stable, economy's good, you know, interest rates are normalizing. What the heck's happening to the market? But what we need to do is maybe take a step back and talk about the market. What are we talking about? Because we have a market that gets showcased on the television news stations, and that's the Dow. The Dow's made up of how many stocks?
30.
Then we're talking about the S&P 500, right? And that's a little bit broader market, and that's 500 stocks. Then there's funds out there that are total stock market index. Out of the total, Wilshire 5,000, right? So you can buy 5,000 stocks. Isn't the Wilshire 5,000 stocks?
Yes.
So the news stations aren't talking about the Wilshire of 5,000 stocks. They're talking about 30. And it can become alarming because some of the other professionals that we use at Cardesco Financial Network, and Joe, you and your team's great, 30 CFAs, you guys are managing close to 90, almost $100 billion in assets. You guys do a really good job. And we, in a checks and balance system, our investment team at Cardesco Financial Network obviously uses those resources that we have at our disposal with you. There's also others that we use to give input to us navigating people's money with regards to investing. And I was talking to somebody the other day, and they said, you know, a market correction of 30% could easily happen. It could even be 40%. You know, it's happened over time. But then I have to take a step back and say, you're talking about the Dow. You're talking about 30 stocks. If I go back to the market meltdown when we had a financial collapse in this country, there was a pretty big gap between the Dow and the small concentration of stocks, that market, to the S&P, to the broader market, correct?
Right, exactly. And that's where the media, the financial media, does, you know, just sort of the general public, a bit of a disservice, right? When we're looking at markets, we're looking across markets. We're looking across broad fixed income, broad equity markets, other markets like real asset markets, even alternative markets like, you know, hedge fund strategies and private markets as well, to get a much more broader perspective. You know, look, they have to report something, right? And so they tend to key on, you know, the Dow, for example. But you're absolutely right. Honestly, focusing in on one market like the Dow, which is really 30 stocks, is kind of a fool's errand, to be honest with you, particularly when you think that every investor should have their specific investment objectives. And their portfolio should align with those investment objectives. Kind of who really cares what the Dow does on a day-to-day basis? It's really how are your investments doing relative to your overall investment objectives, and are they meeting those objectives? And if they're not, then you have to look at it in a little bit more detail and perhaps make a change in strategy. But focusing in on what the Dow is doing on a daily basis or what the S&P 500 is doing on a daily basis, that does more harm than good. Because, you know, at the very base level, we're all still sort of ruled by our animalistic fear and greed impulses. And if you're watching the Dow on a daily basis, you're not gonna help but get a little bit fearful when it starts to sell off. And that's problematic because that's what causes investors to do the wrong things at the wrong times in terms of selling when markets are down and then buying when they feel great about things when markets are up. But that means prices are high. And you typically don't want to do that. We always want to kind of override those base instincts, and we want to buy low and sell high. And that's why we have an entire portfolio construction framework that we use to design these portfolios. We try to take the emotion out of it, stick to the framework, which is quantitatively and qualitatively based, and make sure that we're not making decisions based on our emotions. We're making decisions based on data, fundamental analysis, those sorts of things that help us construct broadly diversified portfolios that over time we're very confident will help us meet those investment objectives that we set out for them.
So there was a situation, just to bring up a case study, that in this particular person who reached out wasn't a client, just happened to be somebody who kind of knows me from a distance and used to listen to me when I was on radio on the weekends doing call-in shows. And this particular person said, you know, I'm a kind of do-it-yourselfer, but I would call in, I would get some guidance, you would help navigate me. And this particular person said, you know, I was down almost $100,000 when I looked at my accounts at the end of October 31st. And I said, okay, so what do you mean? You can say, I don't know. I don't know if I can handle this. I obviously made a mistake and been pretty good at navigating money. As I age a little bit, I'm thinking about turning it over, giving it to somebody else to professionally handle. You probably wouldn't have been down. I said, you can't say that I probably wouldn't have been down. I said, you were down. I said, but how did you do the year before? How'd you do the year before that? And the individual wasn't looking at that. And when I look at the numbers and I say, well, not bad. You did double digits. You did almost close to double digits, about 9.5% the year before, which you made about $240,000 on your total amount of money that you had invested. The year before that, you did about six and change. You made, I don't know, $100,000+ that year. So you're technically up almost $300,000, and you gave back a little bit less than $90,000. I said, at the end of the day, over the last 3 years, 36 months, you've made close to $290,000.
Mm-hmm.
What's that total percentage over those 3 years? So you weigh it out. The person's still averaging a decent return, and at the end of the day, doesn't have a plan. As I loosely put together a plan, I said, you only need to be very comfortable and actually have a money problem at death, where you got to figure out who you're going to give some of this money to. You're going to have an estate problem. You're worried about consistently earning the nine when you only need about 4.5 to still be comfortable. What's it all about? That particular person was knocked off the chair, never looked at it that way, is just looking at the moment, and then reverted to, well, if this continues, I'm going to have nothing. That's the root of the fear of the market and losing everything. So in trying to put that in perspective and say, let's take a look at how that would happen, why that would happen, and has it ever happened before? We get to the point where it's never happened before. Nobody's had a diversified allocation mix that has all gone to zero, even during the financial collapse.
Right.
So here we are. What we're doing. And here's the response. Well, we've never been in this situation. We have a problem in our country. People are fighting with each other. We have an administration who seems to be putting good policy together, but there's hatred and there's stuff that's not making me feel good and sleep comfortably. We have the dollar. What's happening with the dollar? What's happening with gas and energy prices? Look at all this stuff that's going on. And people want to convince themselves that there is something out there, a boogeyman, that is going to cause this market to continue to do what it's doing. And people are going to open up their statements, or this particular individual is going to open up his statements for the next year, two, or three, and watch it go to nothing. So we know, because history shows us, that all asset classes and diversification keep you from being in that position of losing everything, because you're not putting all your money in one place. So let's go to the other argument with what's happening in the geopolitical world. Is there something there that is different this time that the market is considering? Let's take a look at the US dollar, if you can address that. Is the dollar having some consequence here? And lastly, we have falling energy prices, which usually seems to be kind of an okay indicator. Does that have any input into what's happening?
It's a great story, and it kind of brings up a number of good points. But I think that the main one is that, you know, that's the issue when you don't have a plan, is that you tend to just extrapolate out, you know, recent events into the future, and that can lead you to very dubious conclusions. And again, therefore, that's why you need a plan. I think you got to go back and think about it this way too: is why do people do this? Why do people invest? I mean, you know, you could take your money and put it under the proverbial mattress, but we all know that's a terrible strategy, because you're going to lose purchasing power over time due to inflation, and you're not going to have the money that you need to have in order to sustain your retirement or your lifestyle. One of the things that we tell a lot of investors when we first start talking with them is, look, hey, if you can achieve your objectives by investing in treasury bills, you know, sort of the only risk-free investment out there. Obviously, we look at a lot of insurance products and those sorts of things. And, you know, perhaps for, you know, again, in an entire financial plan, there may be some place within that plan for a small portion of your assets in an insurance-based product. That's really sort of the to protect against the worst-case disaster scenario. But we would absolutely never say you should have all or perhaps even the majority of your assets in insurance-based products, because there are typically very high fees associated with those products. Yeah, they might guarantee you a 2 or a 3 or a 4% return, but you're going to pay high fees for that. And, you know, we think over time you can actually do better than that in a broadly diversified portfolio, plus have liquidity and flexibility and all of those sorts of things.
If you don't have a heart attack when you open your statements, right, along the way.
Well, that's the trade-off. You have to live with the volatility. But, you know, that's why folks that aren't professionals should have a professional on their side.
International investments, international stocks, for example. We have the dollar. Strong. Somebody says they want to weaken it. There's Washington's having a tough time positioning the dollar so that investors can be positioned well. You know, to have a good diversified portfolio, somebody has to go overseas. Talk about the strategy that you've undertaken with us to move some money around and get some money maybe out of the U.S. markets into other markets and where they're positioned today and those international markets, which are not reported on TV and how they're performing day to day, like the Dow, our market is. How's the international market holding up, number one? And number two, what's impacting those investors that have money invested in international investments?
Yeah, those are great questions. And, you know, starting out at a very high level, why do we even have international investments in portfolios? And it's for diversification, right, first and foremost. So we recognize that within equities, the U.S. represents about 52% of global market caps, but you still have 48% of the rest of the global market cap outside of the U.S. So if you're not investing outside of the U.S., you're missing out on nearly half of the market opportunities that exist. And then in addition to that, you know, international markets tend to have low correlation to domestic markets. And what I mean by that is, you know, when the S&P 500 is up, you know, let's call it 5%, U.S. stocks are up 5%, international markets are not going to be up 5% exactly. And if they are, it's just a coincidence. They might be up a little more, they might be down, whatever the case may be. But the point is, they move differently relative to U.S. markets. So when you roll that all up into a broadly diversified portfolio, you actually end up reducing volatility at the overall portfolio level, because when U.S. markets are up, you might have international markets down a little bit. But the flip side can happen and does from time to time when you have U.S. markets down, but international markets down less or even in positive territory, which then again at the overall portfolio reduces that variance or volatility. So diversification is the first and foremost reason why we include those assets in portfolios. And then it's all of the other, you know, additional reasons, such as diversifying off the U.S. dollar, as you talked about a little bit, not having all of our assets based on the dollar, because, again, we know that currencies fluctuate over time. In the case of emerging markets, you know, if you look at where global growth is coming from, 70% of global GDP growth is expected to come from emerging markets over the next 10 years or foreseeable future, right? So, if you know, when you make investments, you're investing for growth, at least in the equity markets, and you want to have exposure to the areas of the world that are growing the fastest, areas like India and China in many cases, and a number of other emerging markets. But these markets are less developed, they're newer, and therefore you get additional volatility. So in, you know, this year we've seen some weakness in international and emerging markets, and that's because there's a lot going on. Today, the issue du jour is the negotiations around the Brexit deal in the UK and how that's going to work out with the UK leaving the European Union, and that's causing some volatility in developed international markets like the UK, like France, like Germany. In those markets. And then as it relates to emerging markets, a lot of the weakness is driven by, you know, some rhetoric that we're hearing out of the Trump administration about renegotiating trade deals with China and the potential for tariffs and a potential trade war. And, you know, that causes uncertainty for markets. And so you've seen some volatility there. So, but this is not abnormal in any sense of the word. I mean, this is completely normal in terms of how markets typically behave. They move in different directions. We're seeing a little bit of weakness in international and emerging markets, but that's not abnormal. It's still, you know, very, very much in line with the way markets behave over time.
Brexit. Can you just weigh in on Brexit? It's in the news. It's headlines currently. Let's explain to people what Brexit is and why it's having somewhat of an impact on the markets internationally.
Sure. So Brexit is the name given to the vote that was taken in 2016 in the UK to have the UK leave the European Union, which is sort of the common marketplace of all the countries in Europe, and that it's smooth trade. You know, they have sort of structured contracts, those sorts of things. But, you know, the larger countries like the UK have been subsidizing in some respects some of the activity that the smaller countries benefit from, and they pay a lot of money into that system. And so there was a vote that took place in 2016 to say, we're not going to do that anymore. We're not going to stay in this union, this market union, because of things like the amount of money that we have to pay into this union, and we're going to get out of it. We're going to leave it. And so that's why they've called it Brexit. So they're going through this negotiation process of how's it going to look. Of course, there are, you know, many, many, many long-term contracts based on the provisions that, you know, that are in those EU agreements. And so when you back out of those things, you have to renegotiate that, and that's difficult. And then is the UK still going to be on the euro, or are they going to go back to the pound sterling, and how's that going to work? And so it's just a ton of uncertainty. And so the hope is that we can get this soft Brexit landing in terms of, you know, no major market disruptions. They kind of muddle through and figure it out, and there's no major dislocations or disruptions. And then the flip side of that is kind of a hard Brexit, right, where there is a lot of collateral damage, and it's very difficult to get through this process. And so, you know, it depends on the day when you look at the headlines. But today the headlines are a bit negative, and that Prime Minister Theresa May looks like her coalition may be disintegrating a bit. She's had some of her chief lieutenants resign overnight, and so they're working through the fallout there. And you know, it may cause some political turmoil or some additional political turmoil in the UK, which then causes a little bit of volatility in those markets. So it remains to be seen. I tend to think that they'll figure it out, right? Because the alternative is that you have that hard Brexit scenario that nobody really wants. And so there's a ton of incentive to figure it out. I think it's just going to take time, and there are going to be fits and starts. And today's a bad day, but tomorrow may be a good day.
We have money positioned there. What would be the strategy based on Brexit? Is there a trimming, taking some money off the table internationally because of the unknown? Or is it buy in on the volatility?
Yeah. So ironically, it's probably more the latter than the former, right? Because when you've got this uncertainty and volatility in the markets, they trade down, which makes valuations look much more attractive. You get more for your money in that case, and you're buying low again. So, we're not advocating or suggesting any change. I mean, we've got a dedicated allocation to these markets, and we're maintaining those allocations. We're not trying to time it and say, okay, we're at the bottom today, let's add more. Nor are we saying there's too much uncertainty, let's get out of it. We know there's always uncertainty. We know there's going to be uncertainty. We know there's going to be volatility. But in the context of a broadly diversified portfolio, we maintain our allocation to those markets. We're actually doing a tremendous amount of capital markets work as we speak to figure out kind of how that piece of the portfolio still fits within the larger portfolio. We kind of undertake this process annually, but really do it internally at our office quarterly. And make sure that we're still in the right position in terms of the amount of assets that we have overseas. So we're doing that work today. We're not suggesting any changes at the moment. We may tweak things slightly after this work is done in the next few weeks, and we'll certainly advise not only our joint clients but all our clients about those changes, and there may be some slight tweaks involved, but it's not being reactionary. It's sticking to the plan and letting the plan do the work over time.
Okay, lastly, Warren Buffett betting on the banks and brokers. I think he mentioned a couple areas there that he's putting money into and has been investing in. What's he seeing by going in and making heavier bets in that space?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's higher interest rates. It's the potential for higher rates, right? That's very helpful to the banking sector, because what do? They borrow short from their depositors, and they lend long to their other clients. So that spread between short-term and long-term rates, as the yield curve normalizes over time and long-term rates rise, there's more of a spread there. So the cost of the money that they borrow is, you know, one thing, and then the rate at which they can lend it out is higher, and so they can make, you know, considerably more money in a higher interest rate environment when that yield spread is greater than where it's been in the, you know, since the financial crisis. So I think he sees the potential for the banks to do very, very well in an environment where interest rates are higher. Also, they're just really cheap, right? I mean, if you look at banks on valuation metrics, they're sort of historically cheap. And so I think that's an opportunity as well. And certainly Mr. Buffett's been a very savvy investor over time, and I'd hesitate to bet against him. So I think over the long run, it makes a lot of sense.
Interesting. Hey, Joe, thanks so much. Joe Cortese has been my guest. He's a senior consultant who works very closely with the investment team here at Cardesco Financial Network and his team at DeMayo Schneider and Associates. Joe, thank you again for giving us some clarity and an education on what's happening within the markets, not just the U.S. markets, but international as well, and also on the front of bonds and the bond market and interest rates. So always good information, Joe. Thanks for the work you do, and we'll have you back again as you guys are doing your work on how to navigate right now and whether or not the capital markets give signs of investing a little bit more internationally or less, as well as here on the domestic front. We'll talk about that in the coming weeks and months ahead. But thank you for joining us and being part of the Your Life, Your Wealth show with me, Steve Cordesco.
Always happy to do it, Steve. Thanks so much.
So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be covering more on the markets, the volatility, what's happening with regards to the investment environment that we're in currently. So we'll keep you more and more abreast. We were over-concentrated a little bit talking about the markets. Normally, we balance out what we discuss, but I thought it was timely to really get into it with regards to volatility and stuff happening within the stock market, interest rates, bonds, the economy, the geopolitical environment, all of that. All of that, very important. So we devoted a lot of time to it today, and I appreciate you being part of the program and being part of it. Now, I know there might be additional questions, and we didn't get through all of them. So if you would, feel free to reach out to me. Ask Steve at cfnplan.com. It's ask Steve at cfnplan.com. Feel free to send me questions you have with regards to the market, your own investments, portfolio, what you're doing with your money. If you want to engage, I'm here for you. So reach out, please. Be more than happy to address your questions. And we will have other guests joining us over the next few weeks that will be giving input as well to the world of financial planning, money, and investing. So feel free to reach out to me. It's simple. Just send me an email, ask Steve at cfnplan.com. If you don't feel as if you're on the right track, you can reach out as well. Be more than happy to do a review. We do reviews a lot on investment portfolios, and we can tell you how you're allocated, whether you're diversified enough, and whether you're positioned the way you need to be positioned based on what you want your money to do for you, not just today, but in the future. So real simple, just say, hey, love to have a portfolio review. Let me know how much risk is in my portfolio, and if the market goes through a correction or a crash, what's it mean? What's the downside risk that I have? And am I positioned correctly for what I want my money to do? It's called a portfolio review. Be more than happy to do it for you. Ask Steve at cfnplan.com. Make it a great weekend. Thanks so much for being part of the Your Life, Your Wealth show with me, Steve Cordesco.
Thanks for joining us on the Your Life, Your Wealth Network. All of our shows are reproduced as podcasts and can be listened to on demand at your convenience. If you're interested in learning more about applying the principles we discuss to your personal financial circumstances, please visit Cordesco Financial Network at cfnplan.com or call our office at 215-558-3500. We hope you'll join us again next time on the Your Life, Your Wealth Network.